On. Hello, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. My name is Joyce Lau. I'm the director of the Human Rights Press Awards. May I please ask everyone, if you haven't done so already, to turn off your mobile phones. Welcome to everyone. Thank you very much for coming. This is our first fundraising lunch. We really appreciate the support. We have chosen today, the United Nations Human Rights Day, to launch the 20th anniversary of the Human Rights Press Awards, which were founded 2 decades ago by Francis Moriarty, and our three organizers, the FCC, Amnesty International Hong Kong, and the Hong Kong Journalists Association. We are embarking on a new era. We have a new look that you will see very soon. And we are also officially opening entries for our next contest today. There are entry forms at the front, and they'll be uploaded onto the website later today. All the proceeds from this event will go to our organization. There are also donation boxes, donation forms, and T-shirts. And if you want one signed by Mr. Steiner, you can ask at the front. I'm going to keep this very brief because I know it's a busy business lunch. I would like to thank the FCC, Francis, Professor Johannes Chan, and I'm going to turn this over to Neil Western, FCC President. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Thrilling to see so many people here, especially in a busy month. We appreciate you coming and supporting this event very much, and also coming to hear our distinguished speaker today, Professor Chan. This event that we are jointly organise is one of the flagship events that we do. It's very important to us as a journalist club to support the journalism community at large. This event recognises journalism throughout Asia. At the same time, it plays a community role in Hong Kong. We have many Hong Kong journalists who enter and win these awards. And also, it gives a voice to the people that often don't have a voice throughout Asia through the works that we scrutinize and then publicize as winners. I'd like to give a big thank you to everyone else who's donated. We had an appeal last month, or 2 months ago, that I sent out a letter asking for support. We've had very good response to that, and that's very heartening to see, and a lot of encouraging messages supporting the Human Rights Press Awards as it goes on from this important 20th year. Again, I would like to reiterate Joyce's thanks for Francis, who's been the driving force behind this for many years, and also pay tribute to Joyce, who has taken on an organizational role and is really helping us to raise the profile of the awards in the this year and in coming years. And I'd also like to thank one of our long-term sponsors, Mrs. Anne Marden, who sadly can't be with us at this lunchtime today, but remains one of our greatest and staunchest supporters. To celebrate the 20th anniversary, we're very lucky and privileged that Henry Steiner offered to redesign our logo. Henry is one of the world's top branding experts and graphic designers. His firm, Steiner & Co., has been based in Hong Kong since 1964. Most famously, he designed Hong Kong's banknotes, so you've probably all seen his work, even if you don't realize it. He has also worked for HSBC, IBM, Hilton, and many other global brands. Today, he will unveil the HRPA's new mark, which he designed, and he will talk about the creative process behind the design that he has come up with. And you'll be able to take one home with you later if you buy a T-shirt from the stall on the way out. Thank you very much, Mr. Steiner.
Thank you, Neil. Could we have the lights down a little bit, if possible? Yeah, thank you. I was asked 2 years ago by Francis Moriarty, for whom I have a great respect, to design the substitute for the old identity. And of course I accepted. One of the questions that I'm asked most often is, where do you get your inspiration? And I keep giving the same answer, but it doesn't seem to penetrate. I say, from the deadline. And it literally is quite true. Now, whether that counts for a two-year interval, I don't think, because it really depends when the flag goes down and in my taxi. And the flag went down when I had the distinct pleasure of Joyce inviting me for lunch, and I'm not used to having attractive women pick up the check. But she gave me, and let's see, yes, here I can find it. She gave me the deadline right there, and that's when the flag went down and when my inspiration started coming. What you see here is a placemat on which I started putting down my ideas as we were talking. And there are a lot of cliches having to do with communication, loud hailers, chains, type. And it's more an example of eliminating. But as I started thinking about this project, I noticed that I saw a lot of locks. And I thought, well, there's an idea there. In this case, they're from the Times, from an airplane, and I think from actually the Post. Just to show you how nature imitates art, these are photographs of locks that I took when I was developing the idea. And the one on the bottom right, which is unretouched, is actually a perfect example of what I call nature imitating art. I found that after I had gone through most of the process. I'd rather get an idea down quickly than worry about it being in a nice book or on a nice piece of paper, so I use whatever comes to hand. Picasso said, when I run out of red, I use blue, and I'll use any paper that's going. And you can see here in one short period on the 3rd of September how I started developing this idea of the lock, and that notch on the clasp of the lock I felt was particularly interesting, and it suggested a nose, and that notch you find on the shackles of locks. And that seems to be appropriate also, because reporters are nosy. There's the expression, a nose for news. And we continued to take this further with whatever came along, and I wasn't thinking about the association of the photograph with the development of the locks, but it's not inappropriate. And here is the sort of cohesive development of the idea, trying out different arrangements for the type, trying out different types of lock. And I thought, well, we'll use headline type. from a typeface that's called Impact, which is not inappropriate. And how to arrange it, I thought, well, instead of having it flush left or flush right, we'd have it centered so that it implies a certain impartiality. This is a very quick sketch of some of the implementation, one of which the t-shirt you'll have an opportunity to buy. And it's not true that you get a discount if I sign it. So there we are. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Francis Moriarty.
Thank you, Henry, for those for that terrific work and for those very, very kind words. Our guest speaker today is very well known by all of you. In fact, his presence here is the main reason that you are here. And I know that at least some of you are his former students. This is going to be the first time that he has spoken at the Foreign Correspondents Club, and also the first time that he has spoken publicly about academic freedom since his promotion at Hong Kong University was blocked. So I'm not going to repeat his resume, which is encapsulated on the flyer, which many of you already have or you can pick up on the way out. My introduction is a personal one. Our speaker has been a supporter of the Human Rights Press Awards since their inception. He's also a winner of the awards. I think it was 1999. And I can tell you that that honor is at least as hard to obtain, if not harder, than a PhD. He is always intellectually provocative and always balanced. He's a strong believer in press freedom, and at the same time, he's a strong believer in the protection of personal privacy, even sometimes at the expense of the news media. He's always generous with his time, and as you have guessed already, he's ever modest. He's always invariably a gentleman of the kind that is getting harder and harder to find, even, it seems, in academia. So please join me in giving him a very warm FCC welcome, Professor Johannes Chan.
Thank you, Francis, for the very kind words. And I always find that it is the most embarrassing moment for the speakers on any occasion when you are described in a way that you can't recognize yourself. And Neil, Ms. Steiner, ladies and gentlemen, it's very nice to see a lot of friends around here. And it's my great honor to be invited to address this distinguished audience on this very special occasion. And let me first congratulate the organizer of the Human Rights Press Award on its 20th anniversary and their farsightedness in setting it up 20 years ago. The award was set up in 1995, shortly before the changeover. And in the last two decades, it has witnessed the change of sovereignty, the outbreak of SARS, the Asian financial crisis, the Article 23 legislative saga, the umbrella movement, the upholding, as well as the denial of human rights, and more recently, in the words of Mr. Justice Bukhari, the coming of a storm of unprecedented ferocity. And time and again, the press plays a crucial role in upholding our freedom, notably our freedom of expression, and gives practical meaning to the notion of accountability of government. So the award to recognize outstanding human rights reporting could not have been more timely or more worthwhile, and the credit should go to Francis. And in this respect, may I urge you to give your generous support to this award. Now, it also comes as no coincidence that this award is made on the International Human Rights Day, and on this very day, 67 years ago, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was proclaimed. And very soon, it has inspired the adoption of two international Bill of Rights a number of regional bills of rights, and many other domestic legislations. In the struggle for better human rights all over the world, a message is clear: freedom is not free. And this is particularly true when I look at the list of distinguished guest speakers of this award in the last few years. And they include Kelvin Lau, who is with us today, Martin Lee, Robert Chung. And the one thing in common among all these speakers, if you count myself in as well, is that they are all victims in one sense or another. So maybe we can call this Distinguished Victim Speakers List. When Francis suggests that I may talk about academic freedom, I was a bit hesitant. This is not the occasion, it's not my intention to do a reply to everything that has said about me in the last 12 months. So I think I'll just step back and take probably a wider look, and I describe that person who has been denied a senior position in university. I try to describe it as a third party. And my contribution probably lies in bringing the issues of academic freedom to the forefront. And people have asked, what is academic freedom? Why is it important? How is it different from freedom of expression that we all enjoyed? There's no single definition of academic freedom. A classic one is, I quote, the freedom to conduct research, teach, speak, and publish, subject to the norms and standards of scholarly inquiry, without interference or penalty, whatever the search for truth and understanding may lead. In short, it is the freedom to pursue what universities is about, teaching and research, without interference or sanction or threat of sanctions. This right to academic freedom is protected in our basic law. Article 34 ensures all persons the freedom to engage in academic research, literary and artistic creation, and other cultural activities. And Article 137 expressly provides that education institutions of all kind may retain their autonomy and enjoy academic freedom. Thus, in Hong Kong, academic freedom is a constitutional right. Academic freedom has both an institutional and an individual dimension. As an institutional right, it protects a tertiary institution's the freedom to engage in its business, the business of teaching and research. And in this respect, a university is not only a place where knowledge is transmitted, but also a place where knowledge is created, gathered, or discovered. A university is characterized by skepticism of and readiness to challenge conventional values. The spirit of free inquiry implies the right to examine, to question, to modify, and to reject conventional ideas and beliefs. And as the president of Harvard University recently put it, and quote, knowledge emerges from debate, from disagreements, from questions, from doubt, from recognizing that every path must be open because any path may yield an answer. So dogma and hypothesis are incompatible, and a university ceases to be true to its own nature if it becomes the tool of the state. To be what it is, the university has to provide an atmosphere that is most conducive to speculation, inquiry, experiment, and creation. Academic freedom is vested not only in individuals, but also in the academic community as embodied in the institution. Thus, the autonomy of the institution is the prerequisite of academic freedom. It also has an individual aspect. Insofar as the publication of the research of an academic is concerned, this right overlaps with the rights to freedom of expression. And in this sense, an academic is protected in the same way as any other person in society and does not enjoy any particular advantage or privilege merely because of his position as an academic. However, academic freedom protects also the process of this inquiry, including the freedom to pursue the search for knowledge without fear of external sanction. And as Mr. Justice Hartman put it, I quote, academics today are not cloistered in ivory towers, divorced from the realities of the world. To the contrary, academics work in association with both the private sector and the public in all areas of advancement. This applies not only in respect of scientific and technological innovation, but in areas of law reform, social welfare, and the like. Academia, with its intellectual rigor, also plays an important role in analyzing and, if necessary, criticizing the nature and effectiveness of public policies and measures, unquote. So this brings academic in potential conflict with the ruling regime, and this is of particular importance in Hong Kong, as academics in Hong Kong seems to have assumed a more critical role in social advancement than their counterparts in many other parts of the world, partly because we are small jurisdictions, and partly in the colonial days, the university provides an important source of expertise and independent and impartial views on many social issues. In the 1970s, when tertiary education was still confined to a small minority, only 2% of the population managed to get into the university, the government realized the potential and constructive contribution of academic commentaries, and with the opening up of the administrations in the 70s, generally known as the administrative absorption system, via the creation of many consultative and advisory bodies, academics provides a constructive as well as an impartial force for social changes. Although tertiary education has become more popular these days, academics continue to play an important role in social advancement, and their contribution could be found in many areas: the constitutional development, the rule of law, social welfare, education, economics, medicine, engineering. There's hardly any area where academic input is not sought after. But independence inevitably means not all views expressed by academics are acceptable to the governing regime. They are bound to be critics, sometimes strong critiques, of what the government has done or proposes to do. Critics are particularly powerful and probably also more worrying when they are supported by reasons and ground upon evidence and research. So in the special political situation in Hong Kong, the independent contribution of academics to social changes is of particular significance, and it is in this context that academic freedom is of particular value, not just to the academics, but to the community as a whole. It is also of great significance since the changeover, as academic freedom is not highly valued across the border. University days are regarded as state institutions and are under an obligation to serve whatever be defined as the national agenda and national interest of the day. And it is because of this concern, this is precisely why academic freedom is written into the basic law in the first place. The threat to academic freedom is real. Since the change in 1997, there are at least three incidents where academic freedom is at risk. The first is the Robert Chung incident in the year 2000. And as you may recall, the then chief executive was apparently unhappy with Dr. Chung's research on tracking his popularity opinion poll. He related his displeasure through his emissary to the vice chancellor of the University of Hong Kong, who then passed his concern on to Dr. Chung via his PhD supervisor, then pro-vice chancellor. The matter was then exposed. It led to an inquiry appointed by the council of the university, and eventually the resignation of both the vice-chancellor and the pro-vice-chancellor. This is a classic case of interference with an academic activity that has not found favour with no less than the chief executive of the Hong Kong SAR, who by statute is also the chancellor of the university. The second incident involved allegations that improper pressure was put on the Hong Kong Institute of Education to silence those academics who have been critical of education reforms proposed by the government. The allegations had caused widespread community concern, and a commission of inquiry was set up to look into the allegations. The commission found that the permanent secretary for education, end quote, being the second most senior official in charge of education, should have realized that her views on education could never have been simply personal, but were necessarily, to an obvious extent, representative of the government. It was unacceptable that she did not express her opinions openly and through proper channels, but instead in a manner with the semblance, if not also the substance, of intimidation and reprisal. The Commission disapproves such behavior unequivocally. Complaining or protesting to the critics directly or through their superiors could have inhibited their will and ability to speak their minds and communicate their ideas, and therefore and improper interference with their academic freedom, unquote. The government decided to take the commission to judicial review. On judicial review, the court affirmed that a threat of sanction against the institute of which the academic is a faculty member or the academic himself from a senior government official who is in a position of authority with the power to bring about the imposition of that sanction, that constitutes an unlawful attack on academic freedom. The court also made clear the threat of sanction could be direct or indirect, explicit as well as implicit. It needs not be immediate, as a sanction to cut funding, as was the case in the Institute of Education situation, it could take a year or more. The power to bring about the sanction could be real, could be apparent. The court differ from the commission only in respect of the requirement of a threat of sanctions, which is very much a question of facts in each case, and it was held there mere discussions, even heated discussions, with the academic in private, without any threat of sanction, is just part of the web and flow of free debate, though the court accepted that the more senior the government officials, the greater the chilling effect of the criticism would be, and one has to be sensitive to what would be implied rather than explicit. The permanent Secretary for Education was answerable to the then Secretary for Education and Manpower, who is now rumoured to be appointed as the chairman of the Council of the University of Hong Kong. From almost any count, that candidate is probably a lot more controversial and divisive than I am, and yet the chief executive seems to be adamant to appoint him as the chairman of the council. It forced one to ask the question, is that appointment in the best interest of the university wearing his chancellor hat, or in the best interest of the government wearing his chief executive's hat? The third incident differs from the above two incidents in that first, there was no clear direct evidence of government interference, and second, the failure to uphold institutional autonomy came from within. Unlike the first two incidents, neither the chief executive nor the council was able and willing to defend the system, as in the first two cases, commission of inquiry was set up by the university or the chief executive. On the third incident, unfortunately, the chief executive and the council became part of the problems. The incident is well known to many people here, which I would not repeat it. A chap who was the former dean of the Faculty of Law was offered the positions at a senior level of the university. And the recommendation, almost as soon as it was made, was leaked out and then was criticized in November last year by a pro-China newspaper, apparently on the ground that the candidate has during his deanship failed to prevent his colleagues from promoting and eventually conducting a massive movement of civil disobedience. And diverging that a bit, as the dean at that time, I believe my purview is to ensure that my colleague is properly doing his job, which is teaching, research, and administrations, as long as he fulfilled those, and as long as he is giving a pledge that he's not going to take advantage of his position in classroom to promulgate his political agenda or political views. What he did outside the classroom and outside the university is none of my business. We can't even discipline our own children, let alone academics in my faculty. But nonetheless, that seems to be the linkage between the attack and the appointment. And since then, extensive smearing attacks were launched at the candidate for a continuous period over 9 months. The council then decides to further postpone the consideration for the appointment at the now well-known waiting for a non-existent provost on that excuse. And despite the strong plea of the convocation, the alumni, and clear expression of views of staff and students, the council eventually decided to veto the recommendation. And no reasons was given for this departure from the well-established practice of normally following the recommendation of the search committee. From information subsequently leaked, the reasons are too scandalous even to be recited here. But is there an interference with academic freedom? Without a proper inquiry, as it has happened in the last two incidents, it would never been able to fully fathom the facts. This has been made even more difficult when the Council's way of conducting its affairs these days has become the very opposite of transparency, openness, and accountability. On the other hand, an overwhelming and sustained attack with, I was told, over 350 articles over a sustained period of 9 months on a candidate for a position at the university by the pro-China media, and that include even the People's Daily, is to say the least highly unusual. And that attack coincidentally came after the end of the controversial Occupy Central movement and is somehow linked there. So the candidate is apparently not favored, not because of the ability, but of his liberal political stance. And when the University Council is prepared to depart from its usual practice without proper reasons, and when the reasons that will eventually leak, despite attempts to suppress their leakage, are regrettably ridiculous, I think it does not require a PhD to conclude that there must be political interference with the appointment. Interference from whom? Certainly not from the candidate. Now, according to the UN International Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Committees, it said academic freedoms includes the liberty of individual to express freely opinions about the institution or system in which they work. So if an academic is penalized for his political view, this is a frontal attack on academic freedom. At one stage, a prominent council member has said that the candidate did not seem serious about the job because he criticized the council which was to consider his appointment. If it means that an academic has to refrain from expressing his criticism of his own institution when he is looking for an appointment to a senior position, this is just another kind of interference with academic freedom, let alone an issue of integrity. It is painful even to recollect these events. On my part, as I have mentioned before, this incident is not about myself. If it were just about my own career progressions, I would have withdrawn long time ago. But it is about something which are more important. It's about our fundamental rights and freedoms, about what a university means to us. And I'm glad that the concern of these critical values is widely shared among not just academics, but also people from all walks of life. The incident has attracted concern from many people in the international community, the academic community, as well as the press community. On a loose count, the incident has been reported by New York Times, BBC, CNBC, The Guardian, Times Higher Education, Reuters, Wall Street Journal, Agence France-Presse, and many other internet news. If they were to be taken into account, I think I probably would have achieved a much higher impact factor if that ever applies to a person. An immediate consequence of this incident is the negative impact on the reputation of the university. Not to misunderstand me, I think the universities are still very good universities, and there are still very strong support for academic freedom, and everyone is trying their best to do what is the right thing to do. But nonetheless, the incident leaves behind a question mark over whether academic freedom is still respect or will still be respect and upheld in Hong Kong. And it is not just about my university. The impact is on all tertiary institutions. And would this have an effect over international collaboration, as academic freedom is highly valued in the international academic community? The second consequence is how far this would affect academics, particularly untenured academics, to express their views on social or politically sensitive affairs. Some junior academics have told me that they would now think twice before they are to express such views, and it is sad, particularly for people who work in social science and humanities, which by nature of their work inevitably brings them into conflicts or into the areas of politically sensitive issues. The perception of interference with academic freedom will also have consequences on recruitment of talents and retention of staff, the impact of which is still to be seen. These incidents also highlight a systemic problem. When interference comes from the chief executive office, as in the Robert Chung case, or from a senior government official, as in the Institute of Education case, how could the chief executive continue to be the chancellor of the university? How could academic freedom, in the sense of freedom from interference from government, be reconciled with the fact that the head of government remains the chancellor of the university, who is not satisfied with the conventional ceremonial role. The chief executive is prepared to exercise these powers, and in some cases, such as the Academy for Performing Arts, he could appoint up to 80% of all council members and exercise full control over the institutions. For historical reasons, the chief executive is made the chancellor of all universities in Hong Kong. There's no reason why this practice could not be changed, as it is inimical to academic freedom and institutional autonomy. It is unclear if the university themselves are prepared to initiate amendments to remove this anomaly. However, an opportunity will arise in the near future, and that may be a litmus test on this. The Institute of Education has recently been elevated to become a university. This will require an amendment to the Hong Kong Institute of Education Ordinance. There's nothing to prevent the introduction of amendments to remove the chief executive from being the chancellor of the new university. This amendment does not involve any public expenditure or government structure, and therefore its proposal does not require the consent of the chief executive, who would in any event be in a position of conflict of interest. Academic freedom has to be defended by the institutions. In the first two cases, the university is prepared to defend its autonomy. The third case highlights the problem of a council that is alienated from the majority of the university community, that is insensitive to issues of academic freedom, and that is too ready to hide behind the cloak of confidentiality. It is clear that reform of the council is badly in need. Academic freedom does not exist in isolation. When it is at risk, it is a warning that other fundamental rights and freedoms will be endangered. We must remain vigilant. And in closing, let me take this opportunity to thank everyone sincerely for the kind words and support that you have shown me over the past 12 months. Thank you.
Well, I told you he was intellectually provocative and balanced, and I think we've seen an example of that. I just want to assure you, Professor, there is nothing so scandalous that it cannot be repeated in this presence. The professor is willing to take Q&A. Neil Western will moderate that, I believe, as soon as he gets his microphone over there. And if anybody has any questions, please raise your hand and identify yourself and your organization if there is one. So with that, do I see any hands in the house? David Schlesinger, and I'll turn it over to Neil.
David Schlesinger, do you think that the VC should have resigned over this issue, or do you think that he is able still to properly represent the university?
Well, I don't see why the VC should resign, and indeed from what we have heard or found from the information that has been leaked, he has been trying to do his best. And I think he has a difficult job, and I don't see any reason why he should resign.
Thank you. Steve Hines, and then the gentleman in front.
Steve Hines. Professor Chan, can I ask you, because you refer to this, what would the consequences be for Hong Kong University if Arthur Lee becomes the next head of the university? Chancellor, I should say.
He will make history to be the first chairman of the council who got the opposition of 95% of all staff and students, and which will make life very difficult in a way. It is not about him personally as such, but rather the style, and he is not known to be inclusive. He's not known to be able to bring people together, and this is what university needs at this moment, and I think it's not just university, but also it reflects what Hong Kong needs at the moment. Is we are increasingly become a more and more polarized society, and whoever in power should have the courage to be able to be inclusive, to bring people together, and Arthur simply is not the type of person in that job.
Thank you. Sorry, down at the front here.
Yes, thank you. I'm Houghton Lee, the FCC member. Okay, there have been recent, in the recent month, a lot of the Chinese language press, even the SCMP, of a coverage that the Hong Kong University have been falling in a lot of global rankings based on a few international ranking sources. And a lot of the Chinese language newspaper have been incarcerating the Hong Kong U that because of the university tolerance of a lot of the active participation in the political activities of some of the academics, that's why it is fallen. Now, I have two questions. First, are they really logically related that you're falling ranking and because of some of the academics are outspoken and direct participation in some of the political activities, are they logically related? And my second question is, as a senior teaching staff of the Hong Kong U, how do you comment on this recent falling of the ranking of the Hong Kong University? What caused this falling? You know, what happened, you know, at the university? Thank you.
Right. And ranking is a fairly tricky business these days, and one really has to look at the criteria and different ranking used, different weighting and different criteria. And it is more instructive to look over a period of time rather than just individual years. So that's my first point. The second point is academics are involved in politics or involved in giving their views on highly politically controversial issues. Happens everywhere in the world. I recall I was on sabbatical last year, indeed, when a lot of criticism was made against me about my role in Occupy Central. I was not in Hong Kong throughout that period. And I was on sabbatical and teaching at UPenn School of Law. And the UPenn Law School, the colleague next to me, is advisor to Hillary Clinton. And that speaks about the academic community because of their very nature. And these days, academics agree that they are not cloistered in ivory tower. They have to bring the knowledge to the world. So inevitably, that brings them to comment, criticize on worldly affairs, on matters of social policies and matters of controversy. So on that count alone, I do not see any casual linkage between the fallen ranking with participation in politics as such. This happens everywhere. On the other hand, for a number of ranking, almost 50% or 40% of the weighting goes to peers review, and basically they go around asking people in the university, what do you think about these universities? So it's a general impression. But given the widespread concern about academic freedom, about how the government's is interfering or politics is going into the university, that has caused more damage than other. And if there is any falling in the ranking, this may well be the reason why than the academics involved in politics as such. And as to the other ranking is everyone's trying to work with the system and the polite way is you try to improve your ranking by improvement. The skeptical way is you try to beat the system by looking at the criteria and work on it and so. But among those, on the whole, it is a healthy thing. It makes university more accountable as long as it's not overdo it. And it is a reminder that competition is very keen worldwide and everyone is looking at what everyone is doing. And throughout the last 12 months, I think I received a lot of concerns from overseas academics community and overseas academic, and they just ask, what's going on? And academic freedom is dear to the heart of many academics, and that might go to the decline in ranking.
Thank you, lady here, and then at the back.
Hi, thank you, Professor Chen. Chen Alino from the Australian Consulate. You mentioned that academic freedom is a constitutional right in Hong Kong. The three examples that you provided of, which you interpreted as threats to academic freedom, I mean, do you see that in a broader context as threats to the basic law and to the sort of underpinnings, the constitutional underpinnings, of freedoms in Hong Kong? Thank you.
I think the first two incidents, the first incident seems to be more personal, that the CE was simply unhappy that his popularity poll has continued to drop at the lowest. That itself probably may not necessarily be related to any wider political issue as such. The second is clearly a sort of situation where the government is not happy with consistent critics of the government's education policy, particularly over small class policy. The academic involved their advocates for small class teaching, and that was against what the governments want. And so up to a moment, the senior secretary told the management of the universities, could you just remove these people and tell them to shut up and so on. So that is the and that is something of concern. And the government, if it's not tolerant of this kind of views, then academic freedom will be endangered, and we will lose a lot of valuable comments and insights on the defects or problems with the policy. That's more local. I think the third one is more difficult because it seems to be related to the wider political atmosphere. On the one hand, after the Occupy Central movement, a few analyses or conclusion have been drawn. One is the youngsters are now going out of control, so we need to do a lot more to the youngsters, and a lot of these youngsters are nurtured in university. And so these days we have a lot of tours, study tours to China, etc., and you won't believe it, $200 get you 1 week in Beijing with hotel and airfares, everything covers. I would like to join, but I'm not eligible. And the other analysis is that the academic institutions is getting out of control. They are at the back of that. In my case, I was said to be condemning my staff in doing this. One of the organizers of Occupy Central comes from the law schools. One of the student leaders is my students, so this must be a counter-revolutionary basis and so on. And more than that is during that period of occupying, and a lot of academics were seen to be supportive of the students. Some of my colleagues went down to Queensway to organize classes, to give them makeup class when they cannot attend classes, when they skip lecture, university is not taking disciplinary action, instead we video all the lectures to make sure that they can continue their studies and so on. So it seems that academic is going a bit out of hand, all these institutions, and something should be done. And that is that coincides also with a tighter atmosphere across the border. And apart from 2 years ago, there are circulars from the Education Bureau about areas that university cannot openly discuss, including constitutionalism, independence of the judiciary. These are things which universities are directed not to discuss and teach the students. And in the last 12 months, we have also a renewal of a practice which have long been suspended, which is all the senior administrators of the universities are summoned to go to study classes. This happens during the Cultural Revolution, it happens in the early 80s, that the people are required to attend classes to study the speeches of the national leaders. It has died down for a while, but then it was revived. And I come across my colleagues in the mainland universities, say, sorry, I can't entertain you, I have to go to this class 3 days, it's an absolute waste of time, but we have to go. So the wider atmosphere, is, it seems that a tighter control is being exerted on the university. There could also be some misunderstanding about the university from what I have heard. In the mainland system, for example, the one who is in control of staffing and resources will be the one who controls the university. And this post in universities in the mainland is almost invariably occupied by the party secretary who sit alongside with the vice chancellor and so on. So to allow someone with such unruly records to be in charge of staffing and resources seems to be a risky practice. Although in Hong Kong, it's these are the sort of positions that no one really wants to. These are thankless job in a way, and nowhere glamoring or and so on. And it is also, so it seems that there are a misunderstanding in how university operate, plus the general atmosphere against trying to tighten up all these discussions as a result of the Occupy Central. All these contribute to what has happened. So the third incident, in a way, is worse than the first two incidents.
Thank you. I think we've got time for two more questions. One at the back there, and then the gentleman over there after.
Hi there, I'm Laura Mannering from AFP, Agence France-Presse. You mentioned that
some junior academics felt that they couldn't, or they were worried about expressing themselves, their political views. And from our own research and stories, we found this is something that teachers are talking about at high school level as well, worry about what they should say. Not because anyone's directly threatening them, but because they're worried about repercussions. Is that something that particularly worries you? Because it's hard to pinpoint or investigate specifically, and how can it be counteracted?
Yeah, I think that is something known in other fields as well, and particularly among the press, something we call self-censorship. So sometimes the sanctions need not be real, but the worry that you may be sanctioned, either in terms of repercussions or lack of promotions and other things. And this is something real, and this is something worrying. And among other things, there are also a particularly sensitive issues now is whether you allow students in university to discuss about Hong Kong independence. And there are junior academics who are a bit worried about discussing these issues. And I recall that that issue was raised earlier in the year when the chief executive criticized the Hong Kong U students for publishing a few articles on Hong Kong independence in their official magazine, The Undergrad. His criticism only makes more people to read that, and their books was immediately sold out as a result. And when the chief executive said he has his own personal freedom of expressions to criticize, now this is true, but when you did it, and the policy speech at the legislature, now it can hardly be personal then. And so my own view on this matter is I personally have some reservations about Hong Kong independence, but then I think this is a matter which should be discussed in a rational manner. It should be openly discussed, and it is controversial. But if university cannot be a place to discuss controversy, where else could we discuss controversy? But the worst part is when there may not be actual sanction, but when people feel or fear that they might be sanctioned, then people start to exercise self-censorship. And that's a worrying part.
Thank you. The last question over in the corner here, please.
I'm George Ho, and I'm a secondary six student from a local school, Yinghua College. And I guess I'm the only student in the room, so I will ask questions from a student's perspective. I have two questions. First of all, how will the lack of academic freedom affect the learning of university students? And secondly, I would like to read law in university. And would you recommend me to read law in a foreign university where the academic freedom is more well established? Thank you.
I think one, we are all students in one way or another. Learning does not stop at universities. As far as the first question, the study of law, of course, I think even in the most repressive regime, there will always be people who want to study law, who want to try to uphold certain fundamental values. And precisely because these values are universal, it is all the more important to test our beliefs. And one thing I keep telling the students is that if we discuss human rights in a classroom or in a setting like this, very few people will be against human rights because there's nothing to lose. Now, it is only when you find that you have to give up something, and particularly give up something that you already enjoy. Now that is the test of how committed you are to human rights. Law is certainly, among other things, is a highly intellectual discipline, which I would certainly recommend to you, and it is intellectually rewarding. But then more important, I think, if you want to contribute to a particular society, I think it gives you context. And one thing, for example, I told some of the mainland students who study in our university, especially if you come to my human rights class, I said, other places can teach you what right to demonstration is, but only by going to the June 4th event, going to the 1st of July, when you are actually in the group, get a feel of yourself, what demonstration and peaceful demonstration means. This is not something we can recreate anywhere, and it is something which is inspiring as a matter of learning.
Thank you very much, Professor Chan. I'm proud to make you the first recipient of the new HRPA logo T-shirt. Please give him a round of applause.
Press in the back, if you want to speak to Professor Chan, some of you may want to leave yourself plugged in. He's going to come back and speak with you.
It's at the desk there, yeah.
Okay.
I'll be right with you.
Okay.
Take a picture first.
So you tell me where to spend here like that.